Well, thank you, first of all, to Sherry, who has done so much in the way of getting this lecture series to happen, and just now speaking for the Arithmi, and serving, obviously, as stagehand and most everything else, which is very much in the spirit of Camp Hill and very much in the spirit of Sherry. And also Rick Ruffin, sitting in back, who through the branch work has also been tremendously supportive and encouraging. And you know, to imagine that we have a four lectures, thank you, on Saturday mornings in the beautiful month of May, it's really taking a big risk, and I thank them for saying yes. And I wondered why Sherry placed it on a Saturday morning in May. Well, of course, Sherry, who's basically the creator of the world standard biodynamic planting calendar, she knew today was the waxing moon in Leo, of course. So I don't know how I ever doubted that sagacity, Sherry. Thank you so much. And thank you to Raimunda for the Arithmi. I should mention in passing that 1919 marked the 7th anniversary of the origin of the art of Arithmi, but Steiner waited those 7 years before giving public presentations. Otherwise, it was always to members or those closely connected with anthroposophy. 1919 was the year that Arithmi began to go out into the world. And one of the most significant, and according to two people I knew who saw this performance, actually, I'll get back to them in a moment, a group of German children were sent to Switzerland in the spring and summer of 1919 because there was no food in Germany. And these children were starving and very ill. And so they were lucky enough to become part of a group that came to Switzerland. And they were housed near the Goetheanum. And they were then shown the first children's performance of Arithmi. And this was then to become, of course, a mainstay of Waldorf education as well. So 1919, very, very special year, as we'll hear. Just a couple of other things I want to speak about this year. Why did I get interested in talking about this 1 year? Certainly Steiner was active for many other years as well. Well, this tie that I'm wearing, for example, this tie is actually a 1940s tie. But when I would wear it before my class, especially as they got a little older, they'd all groan and say, "Mr. Schwartz, it's not 1919 anymore." I don't know how they knew about 1919, but anyway, it got me very interested. You know, so why 1919? Oh my gosh, that's when the Waldorf school started. Of course, they knew that, I didn't. It's also an interesting year because it's we have two digits that repeat themselves, right? The 1919. How often does that happen in a century? Quick.
Once.
Once, which means how often does that happen in a millennium, in a 1,000-year period? No? 10 times. Only 10 times. When is that going to happen in this century?
Next year.
Next year. Maybe you've noticed the 2020 showing up a lot in newspaper articles. I don't know. People seem to be very interested in this year for one reason or another. But yeah, it's going to be a significant year. 1818, a very significant year. One of the darkest years in the 19th century for Europe, for very much the same reasons that 1919 was in the 20th century. The Holy Alliance had finally overcome Napoleon, had set up a new map of Europe, new peace treaties which guaranteed future war, and so on and so forth, and mass starvation, unemployment, and tremendous demoralization of the masses as the Industrial Revolution began to make its way from England through Germany, France, and take its great toll on people, history does have a way of repeating itself. As Karl Marx, whose name was on the tongue of many people in 1919, said, "History always repeats itself, the first time as tragedy, the second time as farce." So in 1919, we'll see if there's any sort of farcical aspect of this. I don't think we'll feel that really happen. So it's significant, even numerically, even in terms of its appearance in the progression of the millennium, the very last of these double digits to appear in the entire second millennium. 2020 will be the first in the third millennium. Very important, these moments. We give it some thought. Now, the lectures that I'm giving, just to give you a sort of overview, today I will be dwelling especially with the winter season of 1919, and especially the ramifications, the ripples, the echoes, the tremors still living on from the Great War, which by that time was already being called the World War, not World War I, but World War. We'll be looking especially at the political, social side of things. And relatively speaking, Rudolf Steiner will not feature very prominently in this first lecture. The second lecture today will be dealing with the life of education and looking at some biography. So it's going to be less macrocosmic, like lecture one, which is all about great movements and meetings, and more microcosmic, seeing how certain individuals began to work towards the transformation of the educational life. And since it's about the spring of 1919, we'll hear about Rudolf Steiner's conversations with Emil Molt, and we'll learn a little bit about Emil Molt and about the particular economic circumstances that made it possible for the Waldorf School to form to begin with. And what's interesting is here I am speaking, including to a couple of people who were involved with our local Cambridge and Waldorf School, and the Cambridge and Waldorf School's genesis has a similar sort of set of circumstances, especially from the economic side. It too is a very special formation of a Waldorf school. Next weekend, and I hope you can come to all four, of course, although each one of these lectures will stand independently if you can't. Next week, we'll be looking at the cultural life in particular, at artists, writers, what was going on in the realm of the spirit, we might say, especially in the summer of 1919. And this is the time that Rudolf Steiner is giving the incredible first lectures to the newly founded group of Waldorf teachers. And we'll hear about the founding of the Waldorf School at the very end of the summer, the opening of its doors in early September. And then the fourth lecture, we will be following the biography of the Waldorf School and seeing how much that Steiner planned. How did it really work out? Anybody involved with a Waldorf School now or at any other time probably already knows the answer to that one. Did it work out as things were planned? Very unlikely. And it's very interesting how this all worked with the Waldorf School in particular. And we will also see then how the Waldorf School becomes the matrix, the nexus of not only a new educational movement, but also of the so-called daughter movements, which start to follow like dominoes one after another as the Waldorf School establishes itself, then other groups start to approach Rudolf Steiner. Not in 1919, we won't go into detail about that, but just to see how the light that is shed by the Waldorf School starts to illuminate the life of anthroposophy, and how Rudolf Steiner himself faced the greatest and deepest crisis of his life, which really was not the Goetheanum, not the burning of the Goetheanum. It was really World War I. It was that war that those who knew him said that he, carrying, as it were, the spiritual mantle of Europe, could feel every gunshot, every piece of shrapnel, everyone being gassed, whatever, that he experienced this personally in a very deep way, and did not know at the end of the war if he could carry the spiritual life of Europe any further. On what would the basis be? And I'll be speaking about that in the fourth lecture. But don't get too concerned. The answer was, yes, he could. We wouldn't be here if the answer was negative. But just to, again, go through some of that drama that was there. And just one more word of an introductory nature. There is a very strong tendency in the anthroposophical world, which has been also really voiced and articulated by individuals like Sergei Prokofiev and Thomas Meyer and Peter Selig to some extent, that because Rudolf Steiner was such a unique individual, because he was an initiate, because on a certain level he was free of karma, he did not have to come to the earth when he did, that the context in which Steiner lived, the time in which he lived, 1861 to 1925, is very insignificant when we talk about Steiner's achievement and Steiner's work, that he could have come at most any time and done something equivalent. So we shouldn't spend time trying to say, well, look, eurythmy, that's just like this dance form that was going on in 1910, or yes, there was a new interest in transforming drama. And look at Expressionist Architect and even Art Nouveau, you see touches of the Goetheanum. No. That, don't believe that Steiner's picking up little pieces of other people and gluing them together in the name of spirituality. So there's a good point to that. And most of you probably have found that when you read Rudolf Steiner, you're not thinking, well, what was going on in 1908? Well, why was he talking about this? It's hard enough just to master what you're reading, what's in front of you. It's hard enough just to deal with him on a perceptual, no less conceptual level, to then try to fit it together with other things going on. So this is a real weak point in our work, I believe. And I think it's one reason that there is perhaps not as much interest in anthroposophy in the outer world as there might be, because there's not much interest in the outer world surrounding Steiner among us anthroposophists. We really have to see it working both ways. Nearly 100 years after his death, there are only 50,000 members of the Anthroposophical Society worldwide. It's a long time to pass for such relatively small numbers. Now, mind you, they're all working like, you know, people 10 times their strength and so on. So sure, a lot gets done. But it's something for us to think about. So you're going to hear a lot of things today that have never been discussed about Steiner in the context of his time. Just a warning to you, and you'll have to see for yourself, is this a worthwhile means of inquiry? I'm giving four lectures. That's a lot to ask people to come to. I could easily be giving 12 lectures instead of four seasons, giving a lecture on each month, My preference, given the research I've put into this, would be to give 365 lectures. Thank goodness it wasn't a leap year. This might have been the busiest year of Steiner's life and career, and we'll see why in a little while. It was an incredibly active year in which a lot of what he was doing began to change its focus, its perspective, and turn, one might say, 180 degrees. And I think that's another important reason to look at this year in particular from the vantage point of what was going on around Rudolf Steiner, too. So let me just look a little bit at what he faced. I'll go back to 1917 because that throws its shadow on 1919. That was the year of the Russian Revolution. That revolution was followed very quickly, which occurred right in the middle of World War I. That revolution was followed with a suit for peace on behalf of the Russians. They made a term that's come down to us still, a separate peace with Germany. And the price of this separate peace, because they could see the Russian army was nowhere near as competent or well-equipped as the German army, they gave 1 million square miles of fertile, rich land, which today is in the area of the Ukraine, Belarus, the farmlands, the grain center of Russian life at those days. They gave that up to Germany in 1917. And at this time then, a dizzying array of governments and non-governments began to form in Russia, but the one that was to prevail came about because Vladimir Lenin was moved from Europe, where he had been living in exile, and brought in a sealed, highly protected railroad train into Russia, where he gave fiery speeches and won Russia over from the Mensheviks, who were the moderates, to the Bolsheviks, who were far more inclined to have a complete revolution, not only demote the Tsar, but to do away with him completely and to change the face of Russia for years to come. Who made it possible for Lenin to do this? Many individuals, but especially those whom Steiner had identified some years before the war as representatives of the secret brotherhoods, the Anglo-American brotherhoods, who were wishing to create an experiment to see if Marxist ideas could actually function in a country. So they got Lenin into Russia, and they funded him well and helped the Soviet Union get underway. When the revolution occurred and Steiner expressed tremendous dismay and tremendous concern again and again for the rest of his life about this revolution, he also said more than once, in 1919 he said it and he was to say it again, mind you, this is an experiment of the secret brotherhoods. It will last 70 years. It will last the length of a human lifetime. 1919 plus 70, anyone? Sorry, I'm still a teacher at heart. 1989, the fall of the Berlin Wall, the beginning of the end of the Soviet Union. By 72 years, the true lifetime of a human being, the Soviet Union was gone, and something perhaps not too much of an improvement, but anyway, something else had come to take its place. Now think about this for one moment. After World War II, just to jump ahead to something which still bears the marks of 1919, once again, the Allies met, war crimes were declared. Once again, Germany took quite a beating, some of it probably quite justified. But nonetheless, the realization was, well, we can't just have a political organization like the United Nations and guarantee peace. We have to bring people together trading. It's all about trade. It's all about treaties, a guaranteeing free trade, creating trade groups. And we need banks to provide the capital, not just for rich countries like the United States or England, but for the whole world. The US and England have these great central banks. Let's create something like that for the world. So we get the International Monetary Fund. We get the World Bank. We get what can be called the liberal worldview, that one will encourage democratizing of governments. One will slowly try to bring the standard of living up to a point, the educational level of people up to a point where dictatorships and totalitarian governments will simply disappear. And it was felt in 1989, this proves it. The great historian George Fukuyama declared it the end of history. He said, now the liberal capitalist worldview is vindicated, and we can see that the world is all ready for democracy, even in Russia. So now we're talking about circa 1945 to 1949. Add 70 years to that. What do you get? Right now, 2019, it looks like that experiment, very, very strongly sponsored again by the Anglo-American Brotherhoods. I'll say more about them in the course of these lectures. There again, an experiment, an attempt, may very well be coming to an end. And what always shocks people is how quickly these things happen. You know, we're talking about trillions of dollars of capital in these organizations, tremendous political power and military clout behind it, if need be. And yet, somehow or other, as I speak to you, tariffs are being formed which are breaking down the kind of free trade that was part and parcel of this agreement.